From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Illinois Public Media News and Public Affairs Director. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. Cheryl Whitlow Thompson is an investigative correspondent for NPR and senior editor overseeing member station investigations, serving as the inaugural editor for that team since it started in 2021. Her career started in Illinois. Born in Chicago, she attended the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, graduating with a degree in speech communication. Then she went back for a master's degree in journalism. From there, she worked at newspapers across the country, starting with the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana, moving to the Los Angeles Daily News and the Chicago Tribune, among other papers. Eventually, she spent more than two decades at the Washington Post, covering politics, criminal justice, and more. Cheryl's been at NPR since 2019, and for more than a decade, she's also served as an associate professor of journalism at the George Washington University in Washington. On top of all of this, she has a new book, Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen, which went on sale in January of 2026. Cheryl Whitlow Thompson spent several days in October of 2025 talking with students at her alma mater. She also talked with Brian Mackey of The 21st Show. So prepare to be informed and entertained with a black journalist who literally has seen everything.
All right, we'll start with a softball. How does it feel to be back in Champaign-Urbana?
Oh, it feels, you know, it's surreal. I think part of it is so surreal. I was here a few years ago. It's been about 5 years, I think, since I've been here. But this is the first time I've sort of toured the campus. When I was here last, it was unfortunately for the funeral of John Foreman, who hired me at the News Gazette. I adored him. And so I came back for that, but I didn't get a chance to really check out the campus. It is amazing how this campus has grown.
Yeah.
I see the South Farms are still there. The cows are still there. I won't tell you my cow story on weekends when we had nothing to do.
Oh no. I see
where
that's
where
going.
I'm going.
Yeah.
But you know, Assembly Hall, and I was corrected and told that it's now State Farm. It's
optional.
Assembly Hall.
It's still
to
Comiskey
me.
Park to me, too.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So it's great. I mean, so many new, this campus has grown. It's beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, the downtown area in particular is you know, it was kind of a lovably dumpy, I guess, is what I would say when I was a student here in the 90s. And it's really like a sleek urban metropolis now. Yeah,
we were there last night for dinner. And I was like, where is this? This is like Oz to me, because when I was here, the News Gazette was down there and there were a couple of, you know, businesses, but nothing like it is now.
Yeah.
So it has really grown. Happy to see that.
So, okay, we often talk about the differences on our program between Chicago and downstate Illinois. How did, you know, growing up in Chicago, coming down here to central Illinois for university, how did that change your perspective?
You know, good question. When I say good question, that means give me a minute to think about it.
Yes. This is good insight for our guests. A lot of guests say good question, or for our listeners, a lot of guests say good question, and it really just means I need a moment to think about that. So, yeah, downstate versus Chicago.
Well, you know, I think one of the things that helped me adapt is that so many of the students were from Chicago, and I also had two older brothers who were here at the same time. One was in graduate school in the School of Architecture, and the other one was in advertising, and I might add, I didn't have a date for the first 2 years until he graduated, because he had put the word out that his little sister was coming to campus, and don't even think about trying. So I was undateable for a while. But I do think I had friends who came here. I met people, and they were all from Chicago. So it was sort of like being in Chicago, but, you know, just being 2 hours south.
Yeah. Yeah. Had there always been an expectation of education? It sounds like your family was very much on that track, given what your brothers were into, higher education in your family.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My parents, you know, my mom didn't have the opportunity to finish college. She went to college, didn't finish. She always wanted to be a librarian. And she ended up as a very respectable school secretary in Chicago. And my dad was a teacher and later an assistant principal in the Chicago public schools. And so I don't know, maybe that's why they sent us to private school. I don't know. But yes, we were expected to go to college. Now, we could major in whatever we wanted, but we were going to go to college. And, you know, I wanted to go to USC, or I wanted to go someplace kind of fancy schmancy. And my dad was like, you can pick any school in Illinois, any state school in Illinois. That's what we can afford. And so we all chose University of Illinois. And I don't want to speak for my brothers, but I think we all made wise choices.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned your father. He was one of the actual Tuskegee Airmen. Can you talk about, you know, what understanding you had of that growing up? Is it something he talked about? Because it wasn't always sort of the cultural phenomena, or I don't know if that's the right word exactly, that it is today, right?
No, it certainly wasn't, which is, you know, one of the things I write about. I always say, when people talk about their books, and they say, oh, it's in my book, read it. I said, I will never say that. Well, I'm about to say that. but it you know, what I wish is that I had paid more attention to the stories he told when I was growing up and the people who came by the house, because some of them were Tuskegee Airmen, and I didn't care. As a girl, the only girl in the family, besides my mom, you know, it just wasn't the military, you know, war, the army. It just wasn't something it wasn't my vibe. And so I just didn't pay attention. Now he talked about the war. He talked about being in Italy. He loved that part of his life. He had photo albums, which really came in handy when I started writing this book, because I had nothing, because he had died by the time I started writing this book. And ironically, he died on Veterans Day. But I always wonder, like, God, I wonder what he would think about this book. I hope he'd be proud of this book. I wish I had paid more attention.
So your undergraduate degree is in speech communication, and I understand it wasn't originally your plan to go into journalism. So what were you hoping to do in life?
I love the fact that you did your homework. Somebody talked to you about me. So I really wanted to go to law school. I wanted to write political speeches. Hey, I'm from Chicago. You know, it seemed like a cool thing to do. I had an uncle who was a police commander and very political as a kid. Oh, the stories I could tell, but I don't think the statute of limitations has run out. So,
I don't want to date you, but Harold Washington is in power at this time, roughly, when you're in college, or
Yes. But before that, as a kid growing up, the first Mayor Daley was in charge. And so he was the one who promoted my uncle to run the traffic division. I will say that I never got a speeding ticket because my uncle told me, this is the Chicago way, right? My uncle said, look, if they stop you, you got to tell them before they start writing the ticket, because I can't help you afterward. So I could say that now because he's gone as well. So he can't come back and get me for this. But no, I wanted to go to law school, write political speeches. And I always liked writing. It was my thing. And my mother was a stickler for the English language. I mean, she would grill me on spelling and grammar and all of those things. And so it became sort of natural for me. And I always really liked my English classes in high school. And when I got here, I thought speech comm, you know, why not?
I'm gonna make sure to let our listeners know it takes a village to make radio, and I want to credit producer Christine Haftfield for doing her research on you.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you.
So I understand it's you're working at NBC5 in Chicago while you're a student, WMAQ TV.
Oh my God!
And that sort of
Christine
that sets you on the path.
Yeah, you know, after I graduated, I thought, oh, I could get a job at NBC in Chicago, WMAQ, and get into reporting. Like, well, duh, it doesn't work that way. But I didn't know that at the time. And so I got a job. I was like a secretary or something like that. And, you know, and I thought, this is not going to work. This is not what I want to do in life. And so it was my oldest brother who said, hey, you know, have you thought about grad school? And so I thought, you know, I thought I was done with school, but, you know, okay. And so my parents agreed to pay. They were wonderful about paying for our education. We never had to pay a dime for anything. College was a lot cheaper then. But still, we were blessed that they took care of everything. And so I applied. I thought, well, I want to, you know what? I love the journalism thing. So I'm going to go and get a master's in journalism. So I applied to the good old U of I. I had only been out for a semester and I got a nice letter back from the director. I think he was a journalism, the department head. I think that's what they called him at the time. I don't know if I should say his name. He's gone now. So I guess it's okay. it was Tom Littlewood was his name. And he said, thanks so much for applying, blah, 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 blah. But unfortunately, we don't have enough seats. So I thought about it. And I am not one. Anybody who knows me knows I am not one to be deterred. I am not a punk. And so I wrote him back and I said, that's okay. I'll bring my own chair. And they let me in. And that is how I got into the grant program in Illinois. I talked my way into it.
Young investigative reporters take note. What did you learn about journalism from your U of I education?
Oh, my God. I had a couple of really good mentors. Professor Bob Reed was my absolute favorite. He was a print guy. And I was in the broadcast. At the time, the program was broken into print versus broadcasting. And I chose broadcasting. And Bob Reed was print. But he was my advisor. And he taught me a lot about writing. He taught me a lot about ethics. What to do and what not to do. And he was tough on me. And I was the only Black in the graduate program. And there was another Black student, John Fountain, who was the only Black in the print program. And actually, we ended up working together at a few places, including the Washington Post. And we actually talked the other day. But Bob had given us an assignment. I don't remember what it was, but what I do remember is that he had given me an A on the paper and he scratched it out ever so lightly and gave me a B+. And I was like, what? And he said, you had a comma in the wrong place. Now, you know how many years ago that was? I still remember it. So that is what that is how much he taught me, that you don't forget things like that. It's like if you want to be in this business and you want to be good, you got to be good. You got to turn in perfection.
Do you turn in clean copy?
Still? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And my students hate it because they use the Oxford comma. I'm like, no, not in journalism. and so I'm always looking for that out of place comma. And I will ding them for it.
You mentioned being only one of, was it two Black students then in the entire graduate
program?
In the graduate program.
Unless there was somebody I'd never met,
yeah.
It was just the two of us, I and John Fountain.
You know, the I in DEI that is so maligned nowadays is in inclusion. Did you feel included? Did you feel a part?
You know, because of Bob Reed, I did. I don't know that I would have without him. Dean Carey was the dean at the time. I don't remember his first name. He's gone too, but he was brilliant and he was pretty nationally known. I just remember when I was graduating the night before there was a reception and he says, "We're so glad you're graduating." So I think that meant like, please leave and don't come back because you just questioned everything. Everything. But it was a good experience and I learned so much from this university, both as an undergrad and a grad. And so I have absolutely no regrets.
I've never understood bosses in news, professors who don't appreciate journalists or journalism students who question everything. That's the ball game, right? That's what we're here for.
It is. And maybe it was more to it than that. I don't know. But I did. I pushed back. I pushed back. And I like to think that's what makes me a decent journalist is that I do question. I do push back. I never take no for an answer. Just like when Littlewood said, nope, we don't have enough seats. I'm like, okay, well, I'll just bring my own chair. There's a way around everything, right, to get what you want.
We're speaking with Cheryl Whitlow Thompson, an investigative correspondent at NPR. She's also senior editor for Member Station Investigations. We'll talk about what that means. She is a longtime investigative reporter. She was the president of the National Investigative Reporters and Editors Organization for 3 years. She was on a Pulitzer Prize winning team at the Washington Post twice, actually. She was also a judge for the Pulitzer competition for journalism and program here. You know, this is a time where we're seeing a lot of supports for students from minority backgrounds, disadvantaged backgrounds, however you want to say it, are under threat, more so in other states than Illinois, I think. But we're certainly seeing that pressure from the federal government. I wonder if you can speak to, you know, if that played a role in your time here on campus.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the black students who came along the same time I did, we came through what was known as the EOP program, the Educational Opportunities Program. And at the time, it was run by Michael Jeffries, Dean Jeffries, who is still local. And if he's listening, hey, Dean Jeffries. he kept us sane. He kept us grounded. He gave us opportunities that we wouldn't have had without him. I mean, I don't know anyone who is not grateful to him and that office for what they provided us while we were here on campus.
So after you're finished with your education, you end up at the News Gazette right here in Champaign-Urbana. Talk about how that job set you on a path toward, you know, you could have been a beat reporter, but you ended up in this more investigative track.
Yeah, well, you know, it's funny. When I was in grad school in the broadcast program, I interned a couple of summers. Larry Waters was the news director at the time at WICD-TV, which I understand is not here anymore in Champaign. Mm-hmm. It was over in North Champaign. Anyway, I interned there in production for a couple summers. He was lovely to give me the opportunity. But then I decided, you know, that I thought print was a better path for me, that I didn't want to do television production. And so I didn't, when I was a student here, I didn't work for the Daily Illini, which I sort of regret, but I never did. So I didn't have many clips to show when I was job hunting. So I remember I called the News Gazette, I called John Foreman, and he just kind of brushed me off and like basically, go away, kid, who are you? You're bothering me. And so finally, I just kept pestering him. And I said, I'm going to camp out on the doorstep of that newspaper. Please just, you know, give me some time. And so he said, fine, come in. And so I went in and he interviewed me and he offered me a freelance job. So I was a freelancer at night, and I went to places for meetings like Muhammad and places I had never heard of. And I survived because I remember going into one like town meeting in the evening. And I walked in and like the room just fell silent.
That record scratch sound.
It was that E.F. Hutton, if you're old enough to remember it, kind of moment. Yeah, yeah. Like everybody's like, whoa, who is she? And so I thought, this could not be good. But I did the story and I came back and I always think that John was probably somewhere around the corner secretly laughing to see if I would survive that. And I did. And then he hired me as an intern, and then he hired me in a paid reporting job. And so years later, and I covered the university, I covered higher education, and I covered the university, which was interesting. But years later, when I would come back to the university to speak or whatever, I would always go by the News Gazette because I have so many fond memories of people there like Jim Dye and Tom Kasich and John Foreman and all my reporter colleagues. And John and I were talking one day in his office. He had become publisher by this point. And I said, John, I'm curious, what was it that made you hire me? Why did you hire me? And if anybody knows John, he was kind of this big, imposing guy. I was scared to death of him when I was a young reporter. And he had a beard and he was very imposing. And he spun around in his chair and he looked at me and he says, it was simple, kid. He called me kiddo. He said, you wouldn't go away. And he said, I figured anybody who was that persistent in trying to get a job would be that persistent in a job. He said, because you brought me one clip and it was bad. And so that's why I hired you. And so now I know why he hired me. And it's funny because I'm still that persistent kiddo.
Bring in your own chair. I'm going to remember that one. So eventually you moved to L.A. You're at the Los Angeles Daily News. I understand that one of your stories led to a resignation of a school superintendent there.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out when Christine sleeps because she clearly is spending her waking hours checking me out. So when I went to LA, I'd first gone to Gainesville, to the Gainesville Sun, where I covered City Hall, and a woman took a chance on me. She took a chance on me, and she ended up being my mentor, Diane McFarland, who eventually was the dean of the University of Florida Journalism School. And we still keep in touch. But when I went to L.A., it was my Daily News Gazette experience that got me there, because there was an editor at the News Gazette who had moved to the L.A. area. And so John Foreman made a call for me. And so I got an interview at the Daily News, which was the competitor to the L.A. Times, to the big boys in town. But it was the scrappy paper. Mm-hmm. And I love scrappy. And so they hired me, and I was filling in for someone who was on maternity leave. She covered education, and LA at the time was the second largest school district in the country. And so I'd never covered education, but I thought, well, why not? You know? Quickly made sources, and you got to get, it's all about getting people to trust you, right? And so I made sources, and I was writing story after story after story. And then I remember they were having a lot of financial issues, and teachers were having to come out of their pocket for things for the classroom. And I remember the superintendent at the time, Bill Anton, he was the first Hispanic superintendent of that school district, and a lovely, you know, person. And he had said he was going to share the pain. You know, he felt so bad for these teachers that he and his staff were going to take pay cuts, and they were going to do the right thing. And one day I just happened to be over at the school district headquarters. And this is why I tell my students, this is why it's important to get off the phone, get off email, get your patookie in a car on the metro, whatever, and go to a place, because that's where you're going to really get your good journalism. So I go over there, and they're having a budget hearing, and the budget director knew me, and he was friendly toward me. And I said, hey, Bob, I said, I don't even know what possessed me to ask him. I said, hey, Bob, I said, did the superintendent ever take that pay cut? And he looked at me, and he just shook his head. He didn't open his mouth. He shook his head no. Mm. And I said, did you? And he shook his head no. And I said, did anybody in the administration? And he shook his head no. And I'm thinking to myself, ding, 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 gotta go. So then I go back and I start, like, you know, making calls, going to people's offices, and found out that nobody had done this. So, you know, I did my due diligence, did all the reporting. We did the story. And the next day, the headline on the front page said, you know, Anton failed to share the pain, or something like that. And, you know, my goal in life was to beat the LA Times. I'm still competitive. I was competitive then. And my goal was to beat them. And of course, they did not have the story. And there was a great education reporter, Sandy Banks. She was really good at what she did, but she didn't have this story. And so we ran the story. And that night, I got a call from a source late at night. And she said to me, she said, I just want you to know, because of your story, it was either that night or the next night, Anton's going to resign. And I'm like, resign? Like, from the job? And she's like, yeah. So, you know, it's late. It's like pre-real cell phone days. And so I'm like, so the first person I call, of course, is the superintendent. And he hangs up on me. So I was like, okay, that's a good indication, but it's not verifiable. So then I knew a couple people on the school board who were friendly to me, and I caught them, and they said, yes, he's going to resign. So I call my boss, wake him up, because it's late. They literally, this is the only time this has happened, stopped the presses. I was like, oh my God, this really does happen. When they had press rooms, and they stopped the presses. But I was so scared, Brian, because I thought, I was a fairly new reporter there. What if I'm wrong? What if my sources are wrong? What if there's always that, you know? I thought, okay, I am either a hero or so unemployed, it's not funny. One of the two. It's going to be one of the two. There's no in between. So I wrote the story the next morning, got a call, superintendent had called a press conference. I slept downtown. I'm nervous. He walks in with a copy of the LA Daily News under his arm with the headline that he's set to resign. And he announced his resignation. Whew.
Yeah.
And it was at that moment that I realized the power of the pen.
Is it difficult to know, even this is somebody who did something wrong, right? They probably should have resigned, to know that
We should have just taken the pay cut.
Well, okay, fair enough. But that you're responsible for that, right? You're responsible for this major thing happening. That's got to be thrilling, but also maybe a little nerve-wracking, maybe? I don't know. Talk about that emotion.
It is. I think it's both. You know, it's like it was good to know that I was right. Yeah. You know, that was the first thing I thought, well, thank God, you know, I'm going to still have a job. But also it is scary to think, and that's that power of the pen, that the power we wield as journalists, we could break somebody's, ruin somebody's career. You know, I have done stories that have led to people, politicians in particular, getting indicted and going to prison. It's scary, but I sleep well at night knowing that, you know, I have done my due diligence and I have done the reporting. And it's not just this side and this side. It's a lot of sides that you need to get to a story to make sure that it is airtight, because credibility is all we have in this business. And once you or, you know, you mess up like that, you get something like terribly wrong, like somebody's going to resign and they don't, or, you know, whatever, you're done. It's hard to come back from that. I mean, people do, but it's really hard to come back from that.
Yeah. Well, and there's that expression, there's no such thing as a victimless crime either, too. Mm. And so I guess if you think there were people on the other end of that story as well. You end up at the Washington Post. You're there for more than two decades. I mentioned the two Pulitzer Prize winning teams you were on. You also covered the White House under Barack Obama.
Yeah, so
some people say White House press corps, that's a stenographer's job. How did you end up there?
I never heard that word used, but I get where you're going with it. Yeah. So I was on the investigative team. I was on the national investigative team at the Post at the time. And, you know, Obama's the first black president. He's from Chicago. I'm from Chicago. I thought, wouldn't it be cool? Somebody was going on book leave, I think. And so I thought, wouldn't it be cool to cover the White House under this president. So I go to the editor at the time, it was Kevin Merida, who went on to run, ironically, the LA Times. But I said, hey, Kev, I said, you know, there's an opening for some time. I'd love to cover the White House. And he looked at me, you know, he said, let me think about it. So I said, okay. So I went to my boss and I said, you know, could I make this happen? And he says, you know, Cheryl, he said, you have my permission. It was Jeff Lean. He said, you have my permission. He said, but you're a hunter, not a gatherer. And I was like, what does he mean? But I got exactly what he meant. And he said, but you know what? He says, you're not going to like it. He said, but you have my okay. So I was like, okay. So then Kevin came back and said, okay, fine. You can fill in for this person covering the White House. I got to tell you, I couldn't run fast enough back to the investigative team.
Mm. Say more. So I think that will be surprising to some people, because the White House seems like the pinnacle of a certain reporter's, you know, dream job, right?
Yes, just not
TV.
This reporter.
Right, yeah. So talk about what is the day-to-day like?
It really was great. I can't speak highly enough about covering that beat, if that's your thing. I love politics. I love the fact that I could be in the Rose Garden or at the press briefing and I'm face to face with the president of the United States, no matter who he is. It was great, right? It's an opportunity that most people don't have. But Jeff was right. You are there to gather, at that time at least, gather the news. You can't walk freely. I remember I tried to sort of roam around the White House and I was stopped at every turn by Secret Service, like, where do you think you're going? I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm new here. You know, I knew what I was doing, but you know, I knew that I wasn't going, but I was going to try it, right? Because that's me. I'm going to push the envelope. But it was great to write those stories about, you know, this country and what and how policy is set and how decisions are made and where they made and by whom. That was amazing. I got to travel with President Obama to Mexico, where he met with the president of Mexico and the prime minister of Canada. And there I am, you know, like flying. I wasn't on Air Force One because, you know, that's a pool. It's a press pool. And I found out covering the White House that they rotate in alphabetical order. Mm. And so it just so happens that it was that other newspaper's time to come back. That would be the New York Times and not the Washington Post. But it was just such an unforgettable experience. And I really do admire people who have the drive and the patience to cover the White House, whoever is in charge. It is a grind. And that's why I say I couldn't run fast enough. Because you have to remember, when you're on the investigative team, we're probably the most disliked team in newspapers because we take forever. to do something, not forever, but once I spent 2 years doing a series.
I was going to say, yeah, you're in the White House, you're filing 3-4 stories a day.
Oh my God, it was just like, whoa, I got cramps, you know, in my hand. It was a grind, but it was a grind that I'm so glad I had the experience. So thank you, Kevin Merida. I had the experience to do, because you can't duplicate that. And I do have mad respect for people who cover the White House and Congress and, you know, and the Pentagon and other government or federal government agencies, because it really is, it's an acquired taste, and not everybody is cut out for it.
You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We are sharing a recent interview with Cheryl Whitlow Thompson. She is an investigative correspondent for NPR and senior editor overseeing member station investigations. She graduated from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Her first reporting job was at the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana. Her new book, Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen, went on sale in January of 2026. We're going to learn more about her research for that book when Dialogue returns. You're listening to Dialogue from Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Illinois Public Media News and Public Affairs Director. Dialogue is an exchange about culture straight from the soul. Today, we're revisiting a conversation with Cheryl Whitlow Thompson, an investigative correspondent for NPR and senior editor overseeing member station investigations. The Chicago native graduated from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign with a degree in speech communication, then earned a master's degree in journalism. Her first newspaper reporting role was at the News Gazette in Champaign-Urbana before moving on to Los Angeles, Chicago, and then the prestigious Washington Post. She joined NPR in 2019. Here's a snippet of a story she broke a few years ago.
Cheryl W. Thompson, an investigative correspondent and senior editor, joins us now. So, Cheryl, tell us about this investigation. What's it about?
So this investigation, we worked together with Texas Public Radio and the program 1A and reviewed hundreds of pages of federal government inspection reports, court records, state safety reports, and other documents to determine how many people died in trench collapses, what happened to cause the cave-ins, and whether those deaths could have been avoided.
All right. What'd you discover?
Well, A, we found that trench collapse deaths are indeed preventable and often occurred when employers violated federal regulations by not having the proper equipment in place, like those metal boxes to keep dirt walls from caving in and suffocating workers. Our investigation also found that companies fined by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, we know it, of course, as OSHA, sometimes ignored the penalties and faced no consequences. For example, one business in the Boston area still owes more than $1.4 million from the deaths of two workers 8 years ago. And at least 10 companies that employed workers who were killed had been sanctioned before for not protecting employees doing trench work. One business was cited 5 times in 4 years, another 4 times in as many years.
All right. So those are civil penalties, right? I mean, what about criminal charges?
Right. Well, criminal charges are pretty rare. We discovered 11 cases out of more than 200 where authorities criminally charged an employer. And even when someone was charged in connection with a worker's death, those charges were often reduced, meaning that employers usually got off with a fine, probation, or a few months in jail.
Now, one of the reporters on this project went to Boston to talk with a witness to one of these horrific incidents in which two men died. Cheryl, tell us about that.
Yes, Ken Bruno was the witness, and he had not been back to the site since 2016. He's a carpenter who was working inside a townhouse on Boston's South End while the two men were working outside in a trench. They were installing a drain, and Bruno stepped outside for a quick smoke and was standing on the sidewalk next to the trench when it collapsed.
I'm looking down, and the guys are down there working. And next thing you know, I seen part of the trench engulf them from the waist down, real quick, like whoosh.
Bruno recalls that a section of pipe attached to a fire hydrant burst, flooding the trench and the street with so much water and mud that it just smothered the two workers.
I knew that they were done.
One of those buried alive was a father of six. There's a good chance that both of those workers would be alive today had their employer installed a trench box. It was the third time that that company had been cited by OSHA for unprotected trenches.
So about OSHA, I mean, their job is to make sure workplaces are safe places. So can they come in and close down a business if they're repeatedly violating regulations?
Well, no, only a court has that authority. What OSHA can do is post imminent danger notices at a job site if it believes the violations pose a threat of serious physical harm or death to workers. But it seldom does that. It's happened only 18 times since 2014.
Okay, now what about employers? What should they be doing? I mean, the trench boxes, they can be expensive and can take time to set up and install. And of course, time is money.
Right. Well, Jack Martin was an experienced plumber putting in sewer lines behind a shopping center in Houston.
Cheryl Whitlow Thompson is also an author. Her book, Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen, went on sale in January of 2026. Last fall, Cheryl was in Champaign-Urbana talking with students at her alma mater. But she also spent some time with Brian Mackey of The 21st Show. Here's more of that interview.
You have spent most of your career as an investigative reporter. You mentioned taking 2 years on a story sometimes. I wonder, what are the ingredients that go into, you know, doing Pulitzer-worthy investigations? And do you still see those investments being made, you know, particularly at The Washington Post, right, where sometimes we've seen a lot of people leave it in the last few years?
My gosh. Yeah, a lot of my friends are gone. Most of my friends are gone from the Post for whatever reason. But I do see investments still being made, and particularly at the Washington Post, because it does appreciate, that institution does appreciate, is known for, became a national newspaper because of investigative reporting and Watergate and Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. And so, you know, what I think what it takes, Brian, is a commitment to doing a good job. You know, people say, well, what about a work-life balance? Which, by the way, I never heard that phrase, you know, until recently. And it's like, I have no work-life balance.
Yeah.
I do my job until it's done.
That's a millennial invention.
Okay. Okay. Well, see how that works for you. It might work just fine, but for me, you know, I still work on weekends. I mean, when I go back home this weekend, I know on Sunday that I have to dig back into this project that I'm working on with two other member stations. And, you know, I've got work to do, even though it's a Sunday. It's like you do what you have to do to get the job done. So, and I think once you do that and you have, you know, good editors and you have a team of good reporters, look, I don't, some people might disagree, but we don't do journalism to win awards. I mean, like, it's nice to be recognized, but the bottom line is you do journalism because you have a good story to tell. You have information that you need to get out that you think people need to hear. And that's why we do what we do. And if along the way we win awards or Pulitzers or Emmys or, you know, whatever, I will say I am very proud of the one Emmy I have. you know, that's great, but that's not what it's based on,
yeah.
Nor should it be.
No, that can lead you down a bad path too. If you start.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yes, it can.
Yeah.
Yeah. A path with a big ego.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want that.
Or cutting corners trying to.
Well, so, that too.
So yeah, I mentioned one of your titles is senior editor overseeing member station investigations. And you know, this is a time of great disruption in public media and NPR, but you know, to NPR's credit, I think, as somebody who's worked in member stations for 13, almost 14 years now, I have seen this increase in trying to make a real, true nationwide network out of the stations, right? Talk about what you're doing with member stations from NPR headquarters in Washington.
Well, this idea was the brainchild, I believe, of Nancy Barnes, who had been hired right before I came in early February of 2019. I think she had come like that November before, and about a year into my job, she created this, and she knew that I did investigations. I came to the investigative team, and she loved investigations, and now she runs the Boston Globe, and she still loves investigations. I miss her being at NPR, but she started this, and she asked me if I wanted to do it, be the editor, the inaugural editor, and I'm like, you know, I'm a reporter. You know, I'm that hunter, not that gatherer that Jeff Lean called me. And I was like, I don't know. And she said, well, just, you know, try it for 6 months. I said, only if I could continue to do reporting. And she said, fair enough. So I was the, I became the player coach. And then 6 months passed. And then, she said, you know, I'd really like it if you stayed in the job. And so here we are 5 years later, mm-hmm. and I'm still doing it. And so I really do enjoy working with member station reporters because a lot of them are new to journalism. A lot of them are new to public radio. A lot of them are new to investigative journalism. And so to get them interested, to see them excited, I will say there was one reporter I worked with, one of the early reporters I worked with. His name is Nate Hedgie. And he was at the Mountain West News Bureau at the time. And now he's at New Hampshire Public Radio. And he had this idea. He came to me with this idea about deaths at tribal jails on reservations. Mm. And I was like, okay, you know, and he was a good writer. And he was a reporter who really worked hard. And I am a sucker for a reporter who works hard. Okay. If I see that you are willing to put in the work, I am willing to put in the hours to make it a good story. And he did the report. Anything I asked him to do, he would do. And it became this amazing piece. And he said to me during the process, he said, you know, he said, I've never done investigative reporting before. And I thought, wow. I said, okay. I said, well, I think you might have a future here because you're doing pretty darn good. Mm. And it was an amazing piece. It was more than one piece. And he had gotten a grant to do it. And it won all kinds of awards. And so I teamed up with him in some of the stories because sometimes there was a daily follow-up and he just didn't have the time. So I would pitch in. And we just, you know, I thought we became a good team. And as a matter of fact, last week he sent me an investigation he had done on some prison stuff in New Hampshire. He says, read this piece. I'm so excited about it. So to see what develops from taking somebody like Nate, who had never done anything, to now, this is what he loves to do, makes everything worthwhile that I do.
Yeah, it's so great that because I think the experience of starting out in public radio, a lot of stations maybe have one editor, one reporter, maybe just one person even, to be able to give them the resources of a true experienced editor who can guide them in a deep story like that is really, it's really striking and a great opportunity for people and a way to bring greater journalism resources to communities that we've seen a lot of disinvestment in journalism in the past few decades.
Yeah.
Only about 8 minutes left in the program. I do want to spend some time.
What? Where did the time go?
I know. Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen. So we talked about your own father's being a pilot in the Tuskegee Airmen earlier. This is about more than two dozen of the men who went missing in combat in World War II, and a lot about the challenges they faced while they were serving. Talk about what drew you to this book.
Well, what drew me to the book was, you know, the story of the remains of one they had found. And
years later, right?
Years later. This was 2018. Mm. And my colleague at the Washington Post had done this story, and he knew my dad was an airman. He sat a few desks over from me, and he writes a lot about historical things. And he told me about this story, and it was such a well done story. And I thought, oh my God, they found the remains after all these years. And I said to him, I said, Michael, do you think there are others? And he says, yeah, I do. And I said, oh my God, that's your book. And he looked at me and he said, no, Cheryl, that's your book. Hmm. And I thought, wow, okay. And so some years passed before it resonated with me, but you know, I thought, I've never written a book before. It was a little daunting for me and not much, you know, terrifies me, but I can write an investigative piece. I can write a series. I can do a news story, but a book, we're talking 75,000 words, was overwhelming to me. And so I got an agent, someone I knew of, and she agreed that, no, this is a book. And so she shopped it around and two publishers bid on it. And I went with one and she said, can you have it for us next year? I'm like, no. I do have a job, you know, at NPR. I did take a leave from teaching because I know I just couldn't do all that. And so I started the book in 2021. My first interview was with General Charles McGee, who was a brigadier general, who actually was pinned a brigadier general during Trump's first term at the State of the Union in 2020, I believe. oh, I might be getting my years wrong.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was pinned, a brigadier general. And so I started with him because at the time he was 100. And I went to his home because he lived in suburban Washington. He lived in Bethesda and Maryland, which is, you know, right outside D.C. And I convinced his daughter, because it was hard to convince her, to let me come over and sit with him, because he was still in demand. Even at 100, he was this, you know, this almost like figure that you, it's like hard to believe. Like, here was a guy who served in World War II, who became a brigadier general, who was in a war where no one wanted him in a cockpit, you know, trying to fight off Hitler's army, and to sit with him. And so I brought my dad's album. My dad had a photo album. My dad was gone by that time, and he had a photo album that my brother had, and my brother sent it to me. He said, this might help you. And so I brought the album with me, and I sat there with General McGee on his back porch, on his deck. And I describe it in the prologue of what that scene was like. So you have to get the book and read it. but it was just this amazing guy. And I learned that he and my dad were in the same, squadron. There were four squadrons to this fighter group that was overseen by General Benjamin Davis Jr. And I thought, oh my God, like, you knew my dad. And so I showed him pictures of my dad from the album, and he stared and he said, he looks familiar. But, you know, I mean, we were talking, like, you know, 60, darn near, yeah, 75 years ago. And so anyway, my long story less. So he was the first person I interviewed. And then I tried to figure out who was left. And so I tracked down those men, because I knew if General McGee was 100, and he actually died that January. So that was August, and he died a few months later. But I also found the others who were still around, who had flown over in Europe with him, and talked to three or four of the other ones. And they were just these amazing people whose life was really tough over there, trying to prove that they were capable. And that's what they spent their careers doing over in Europe, is trying to prove to Washington, which at the time, the Pentagon was the War Department, which sounds familiar now. And they were trying to prove that they were better than, as good as, and they were absolutely. These guys, and I found a white bombardier who was at a service. He was 101, and he told me, he said, if it weren't for those guys, because they weren't known as the Tuskegee Airmen then, but they were known as the Red Tails, because that's the color they painted their plane tails. And if it weren't for those guys, we wouldn't have won that war.
Fighter escorts.
Yeah. They were the fighter pilots, and they were good.
Yeah.
They were good, and they were smart. Most of them were college educated. What sort of still amazes me as I, you know, did all this research and look back on it, is how young they were. They were straight out of college. You know, they were, the youngest one not to come back was 20, and the oldest one was 28. And it's just, you know, they just come across as these older, very mature figures. But really, they were barely old enough to vote.
Kids, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Amazing. You know, just about a minute and a half left in our time together. And
no, say it ain't so.
Well, you've been in Champaign-Urbana this week, right? We're at a time of declining trust in the media. That's been kind of like throughout your career. It's been going down, down, down. What do you say to young people who are considering this field anyway, or maybe they have mixed feelings about it? Is it still a good bet?
It's absolutely still a good bet. And I say to people who are hell-bent on it is, follow your dream, right? Don't be deterred by, you know, things change. People come in and out of office. You know, people move on. But journalism is never going to die. The way it's done, in terms of whether they're newspapers, radio stations, television stations, you know, digital stuff, might change, but the journalism itself is still going to be around, and it's needed now more than ever. We are the people who hold people accountable. That is what we do. That is what we need to continue to do, is hold people accountable. And so for those who are on the fence, I say, like, really, you know, think about, because if you're on the fence, that means you really are considering it. So I say talk to other journalists, you know, go to conferences, talk to, find mentors, find, you know, professors, find mentors in the business who can guide you and sort of help you make that decision. Journalism is not for everybody. Mm. It's definitely not for everybody, but it is an honorable profession. If I had to do it all over again, I would absolutely choose it. I might not choose an editor or two here and there, but I've also had really great editors in my career who have taught me a ton of stuff, and I would not change. It is, I am so proud to be a journalist in this day and age.
This is Dialogue from Illinois Soul. I'm Reginald Hardwick. We've been talking with Cheryl Whitlow Thompson, senior editor and investigative correspondent at NPR. She's an alum of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and a former reporter at the News Gazette. Her book, Forgotten Souls, The Search for the Lost Tuskegee Airmen, is available from Daphina Books. She was interviewed by Brian Mackey on The 21st Show back in October of 2025. That's all for our show. Remember, you can always re-listen to Dialogue on the Illinois Public Media YouTube channel. I'm Reginald Hardwick, News and Public Affairs Director. Lamont Holden composed our theme. Dialogue and Illinois Soul are part of Illinois Public Media, a service of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. Thank you for listening. We'll talk with you again next week.